bowing to her. She started to speak, to say something, but I walked, no, sprinted, away, imagining that she, whoever she was, remained there, watching me with derision. I could almost hear it, her laughter pressing up against my back as I hurried from one street to the next, not paying attention to where I was going, needing to lose myself in the crowd, to put as much distance between myself and that grinning face as possible. By the time I returned home, Lucy was gone. At first I could not believe it, assumed that she was only out somewhere in the city. But then, stepping into her room, slowly at first, as though I expected her to emerge at any moment, I could see that it was true. Her suitcase, her clothes, her toiletries, everything was gone, as though she had never really even been there. I felt the realization, dully, felt the knowledge of what her absence truly meant begin to sink in, slowly, trickling, bit by bit. Yusuf would not speak up. Aunt Maud did not believe me. Worse still, she thought I was the one responsible. I thought of the officer from earlier, his questioning, his disappointment and simultaneous glee as he realized just how many of the questions he put before me I was unable to answer. I knew then that it would not be long before they came. I leaned up against the wall and felt the bracelet in my pocket, solid and heavy. At the reminder of it now, I felt the rage well up inside me. It erupted in that moment, so that its release felt almost violent, such that I could actually feel it leaking from my pores. I tore the plates from the wall first, the force of the movement wrenching my shoulder. I ignored the pain, ignored the trembling of my hands, desperate to have them gone, wanting, no, needing to destroy this place that had once promised safety, a new chance, a new start. It had been lies, and in that moment I wanted nothing more than to destroy it. When my own strength failed me, I ran to the kitchen, my hands encircling the sharpest knife that I could find. This I plunged through the cushions on the sofa, through the leather poofs on the ground, pulling down on the knife's handle with such force that the fabric had no choice but to yield at last, pulling apart at my insistence. My hands were shaking, my breath short and fast. I could feel my heart thudding loudly against my chest as I wiped away the sweat that had collected on my forehead. I had an image then of what I must look like, face wild, teeth and claws bared. I collapsed onto the ground amid the tattered room, now torn into jagged strips, the remains scattered around me like some macabre version of snowfall. And I waited for the feeling of comfort, the feeling of triumph, to wash over me. I looked down at the mess that I had made, but there was nothing, only the feeling of emptiness at the thought that she was gone, that I might never know for certain what she had done then, what she had done now, that all I would ever have were my own suspicions, my own convictions, which suddenly did not seem like enough at all. And there was something else, too. It was absurd, grotesque even, but there was something like a physical ache, just there, behind my ribcage. I remembered the moment at the police station earlier when I had turned to look for her, almost as if there was some missing part of me that only Lucy's presence would ever truly complete. For even though I blanched at the idea, without her, I knew from experience, my resolve diminished. My voice disappeared. Whatever symbiosis existed between us was real, tangible, and now, without her presence, I could feel the absence of it, as if she were an extension of my own person. She was, I realized, that awful, wretched part of me that should be locked away and boarded up forever, like Jane's madwoman in the attic. She was the unfiltered version, the rawness that no one should ever see. She was every wicked thought, every forbidden desire turned real and visceral. I held up my hand and saw that the dye from the leather had stained my skin. "See," I laughed, whispering the words to myself, "you will never be rid of her." I looked down once again, willing myself to feel something, anything. But there was nothing, nothing at all. I heard my name being called, muffled, from the other side. It was the police, I knew. They had returned at last. I looked at the walls of my apartment, desperate to be swallowed up by them, to be consumed once and for all by the shadows lurking in the corners. I should have known that I would never be able to outrun them, that I would never be able to outrun her. I moved from my place on the floor. Strips of leather, of fabric, now stuck to my arms. There was a small piece affixed to my cheek. Pulling them away, gazing down at the strips of canvas, I was gripped with the conviction that none of it, what happened with Tom, with John, with anything in between, mattered. Not really. This had always been about her, about me, about the two of us. And it was always destined to end this way. There was an ache in my head, and I pushed my fingers into my temple. The knocking grew more insistent. I thought about the last time I had heard someone knock on the door like that, the morning that John had disappeared. No, not the morning of his disappearance, but the first time I had learned of it, from that strange man with the scar. I wondered then, and not for the first time, who he had been, and why he had been so reluctant to contact the police. If he truly had been the person following me that day in the streets, if what the police had said about John leaving with Sabine had been true. It made me realize that I had never really known John, only the hazy mirage he had presented to me that summer we first met, a shimmering beacon of hope that I had clung to in my darkest moment. I turned toward the door, toward the sound of someone fumbling with the knob. It was locked. They would not get in so easily. I moved quickly toward the bedroom. They had come for me at last, my invisible shadows which Lucy had made real. But this time I knew they would not go away. After all, the police believed that I was responsible for John's death, if not the actual physical act, then at least in the collusion of it. A Lady Macbeth whispering that could not go unpunished. I thought about John's body, wondering whether they would bury it here or whether they would return it to England. I thought of his eyes, empty. Or at least I imagined they were empty, for they had been closed when I had seen them last. It seemed strange, the idea of returning him to his birthplace. He had loved Tangier, and she had loved him for a time. It didn't seem right for them to be parted. No, it made sense for him to remain with her, forever. I hoped they would realize that. I grasped the knife that I had picked up from the floor. In many ways, this too seemed to make a certain sort of sense, as if all the years in between now and my parents' death I had only been waiting for this, for the end that I was meant for that night, that I perhaps would have succumbed to if not for some strange miracle. Or perhaps it had not been a miracle after all. Perhaps it had only been a mistake. Perhaps I had not been meant to survive, and the shadows were simply warnings, or time watching over me, waiting for my impending death. Perhaps I had always been moving toward this day, all on my own. There was a comfort in the thought, I realized, as I moved onto the bed. I crawled, pulling the duvet back and slipping under the sheets. It sounded now as though a large body was pummeling the wooden frame over and over, so that I worried the sound of it would never stop, that it would go on and on, forever. But then, I remembered, looking down into my hand, it would stop. All of it. Soon. And nothing that had come before would matter ever again.
Chapter 20. Lucy. In front of her, the queue was finally moving.
"Ticket, please,"
the man commanded, opening his hand in expectation. For a moment, she considered turning back, pushing through the line she had waited in for nearly an hour, making her way through the port and into the heart of the city, just as she had done the first day. She could almost feel it, the heat of the Medina pushing up against her, the frenzied excitement that ran through it, as though a vein that kept the city alive, pumping and rushing, working relentlessly so that the rest of Tangier could survive. She longed to be in the midst of it again, suspecting, no, perhaps already knowing, that she never would be, that Tangier would be a stranger to her, now and forever. Well, not really a stranger, but a piece of her past, one that she might take out and examine from time to time, holding it up to the light, but one that she would never revisit. That was impossible. If only Alice had not called Maud. If only Yusuf had not blackmailed her. Lucy handed over her ticket to the attendant and found a seat toward the back, away from the screaming children, their faces sticky with sweets, their parents already wearing the resigned look of those who know they are facing a losing battle. It was an expression they no doubt shared, for Lucy also knew that this was the end for her and Alice as well. There would be no more chances between them. She felt the fabric beneath her shift, and she half turned, surveying the occupant of the seat beside her. The woman was older, perhaps a decade or more than Lucy's own years, but there was something soft and inviting in the way that she smiled and nodded her head. Just a slight tilt, nothing too intrusive. But Lucy found herself returning the easy gesture, suddenly eager to leave her heavy thoughts behind. The woman sighed loudly. "It's a relief, isn't it?" Lucy frowned. "What is..." The woman gestured to the window beside Lucy, which had grown hot and humid from the afternoon sun. Already she could feel the force of it pressing up against her cheek. "Leaving this behind?" the woman said. She let out another sigh, moving farther into the cushion. "Not that I don't love Morocco, of course, but it's always such a relief when it's time to return home. Like I'm, oh, I don't know, shedding my skin or something. Like suddenly I can breathe again." She turned back to Lucy. "Isn't there some saying about it?"
"Saying?"
Lucy repeated. She was staring at the woman more intently now. There was something about her, in the way that she moved. Theatrical, Lucy thought, with an elaborate flourish of her gloved hands. There was a sturdiness to the woman's voice, a confidence that Lucy found herself enthralled with, and she found herself wondering whether the woman did this often, talking to strangers as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Her tone confident, self-assured, as if she was already certain that such a quote existed, and that the question she put to Lucy of its validity, its existence, was nothing more than a mere formality. There had been a time when Lucy had been that certain, when everything had seemed easy and fitted into place. But then the world had tilted upside down, and when it righted itself at last, she had stood in front of the burning wreckage, suddenly unsure of everything. This time more of a change would be required, something more than a simple relocation and fabricated resume. She thought of Tangier and its many names and alterations, of the people who had claimed it as home over the centuries, a vast array of nationalities, of languages. Tangier was a city of transformation, one that shifted and altered in order to survive. It was a place where one went to be transformed, and it had, in a way, changed her. Gone was the girl, the young woman who had loved so carelessly, so blindly, that she was willing to do anything to keep that love. For while she still believed that Alice had loved her once, she could no longer pinpoint the exact time in her mind. Lucy turned back to the woman, to the present, and smiled. "I don't think I know that saying." The woman raised her eyebrows. "No? Well, perhaps I'm just imagining it, then." She stuck out her hand, still gloved. "I'm Martha." Lucy took the outstretched palm, the sweat on her own transferring to the starched material. "Alice," she said, trying it out, shifting her voice just a bit so that the A was higher, more rounded. Martha frowned. Now, am I wrong, or do I detect a bit of a British accent? She asked, leaning in. Her own vowels were long and drawn out like the lazy flies that circled overhead, so that Lucy imagined hot, dusty weather with mud the color of burned ochre. Lucy smiled. My mother was American, but my father was British. She paused, feeling the gears of the boat as they began to churn at last, though I was raised by my aunt in London.
By your aunt?
Martha questioned.
Yes, Lucy said. She felt the boat pull away, but she resisted the urge to turn and look out of the window. She had already said her goodbye to Tangier. My parents died when I was young.
Martha's hand flew to her cherry-stained lips.
Oh, my dear, that is awful.
Lucy lowered her eyes.
Yes. Yes, it was.
She let out a deep sigh, feeling the movement as it made its way through her entire body, until she was no longer certain whether it was the exclamation of relief or the churn of the mechanics that rumbled there.
But that was a long time ago now.
Of course, Martha said, nodding eagerly. She started to speak, but then hesitated. Lucy thought that she could read the conflicting emotions there, politeness and interest, the two of them fighting within the woman. Her back pressed against the window, refusing to look backward, Lucy waited to see which one would win. The boat surged then, and the woman gave a sudden lurch, slapping Lucy lightly on the shoulder.
I've got it,
she exclaimed. Lucy frowned, startled.
What? The saying?
Martha replied, shaking her head as if she couldn't believe that Lucy didn't know what she was referring to, as if they were already fast friends.
There is a local saying here, or there, rather, she said, indicating over Lucy's shoulders toward the retreating image of Tangier and her shores.
Martha paused, watching Lucy expectantly, and then she said, You cry when you arrive, and you cry when you leave.
Epilogue. Spain. In her dreams, she's sitting at Café Jaffa. There is a glass of mint tea before her, only recently delivered, and she marvels at the colors. A rich forest green on top, a golden amber on the bottom. It is one of those perfect Tangier days, she thinks. The skies are a deep blue, the clouds a startling white. She wishes, not for the first time, that she was able to capture it all somehow, perhaps with words on a page or paint on a canvas, just so she can keep it with her always. Her reality upon waking isn't entirely different. The sun still shines, set against an azure sky, only instead of the sapphire blue of the Mediterranean, she faces mountains, green and budding in the first days of spring. Today is Tuesday, her favorite day of the week. On Tuesdays, she wakes early, ladles out coffee grinds into a cup, just enough for one, as she is somewhere else to be. Afterward, she climbs the stairs and drinks her coffee on the balcony, which overlooks the street and one of the town's many steep inclines. She is high up enough that she can see the vast stretch of it, the mountains beyond. At night, when most of the town falls quiet, she can observe those places that stay awake, their lights pulsing in this otherwise darkened mountain town. Today, someone has moved into the flat across the street. She can, from her vantage point, see into the belly of it as they move around, pulling sheets from the furniture, shaking the dust out the window and onto the street below. One of the pieces is an old piano, pushed up against the back of the room. As she is finishing her coffee, music begins to drift out of the window. Two drifters, off to see the world. There's such a lot of world to see. She sits and listens, smiling, drawing out the moment as long as it will stretch. Today will be her last day in the house.
She waits patiently at the bus stop, nodding to the other faces that have since grown familiar to her. There is the couple that owns one of the three restaurants in town, and who serve her cerveza with a small tapa, fish that she doesn't recognize, but that is always oily and salty and satisfying. There is the tramp who has taken up residence in the abandoned shack behind the doctor's house, and more. Other familiar smiles. She nods at them all, but does not speak. No one, it seems, understands English or French in this little town, and so she remains apart from them, happy in the barrier that exists. She climbs onto the bus, pausing in front of the driver. "Malaga," she says, handing over the required coin. It is an hour's ride away, but a pleasant one. She sits alone looking out the window, watching the dips and curves of the mountains as they rush past, a sprinkling of flowers, purple and yellow, coating the green fields. There are moments when she wishes that the drive would go on forever, as she rests her head against the window, her eyelids fluttering. She feels nearly content in these moments, almost at peace. In Malaga, the noises seem to assault her. She has grown used to the quiet of her little mountain town. Here there are too many people, moving frantically from one place to another. It is too hot, somehow, though it is most likely the same temperature. Still, it is uncomfortable here, so that after walking a block or two, her shirt sticks to her back, and her breath comes hard and fast. She pushes her sunglasses farther up the bridge of her nose, trying to shield herself from the sun. Once there, she finds her sitting in the corner of her room, alone. Maud would, she knows, prefer to have Alice somewhere in England. So far, however, the doctors have advised against such a move, and so she has had to be content with sending over a personal nurse, a young red-headed girl who looks frightened at the prospect of spending her time in Spain indefinitely. At least it is not Tangier, Maud had said months ago now, shaking her head. She had told her then about the state that Alice was discovered in, and the arrangements, the arguments that Maud had endured before finally convincing the police that the best place for her niece was an institution in Malaga, not a jail cell in Tangier, that everything had already been arranged at her behest by a friend of Alice's, a capable young woman named Sophie Turner. Eventually, they had relented. It had all become too difficult, too messy for their taste. Independence had arrived and they were eager to start again, to focus on their own, to leave the problems of expatriates to their own countries. They were only too happy to expel the British girl from their shores in the end. She stands next to the bed, looking down at what remains of the girl she had once known, had once loved. It is a curious thing, she has thought often over these last few months as Alice's caretaker, how the feelings she had once had have slipped away, dried up, so that she knows it is time to leave at last. There is a slip of paper on the bed, and reaching down she sees her own name written there. The nurses had warned her of this some weeks earlier, that this obsession with the name has only increased, along with the torn pieces of paper hidden throughout Alice's room. She slips it into her pocket. Leaning down, she places a kiss on the girl's forehead and leaves. She does not look back. This will be the last time they see one another. Her steps are heavy as she heads to Banco de Malaga. Behind the counter, the tellers are startled by her appearance. Usually the courier is sent to deliver the allowance to Alice Shipley, in care of Sophie Turner. She shakes her head and smiles, explaining that she is better now, that her caretaker has returned to England, and that she has come to withdraw funds from the trust she now has full access to. Her birthday only the day before. At their frowns, their confusion, she places a hand to her cheeks and asks, "Oh, dear, didn't my aunt leave a note with instructions?"
"No, senorita, nothing,"
they say, blushing. They do not speak much English, but this is to her advantage. They hover around her, smiling at the sweet foreign English girl who watches them with wide and trusting eyes, so that they are aware of how alone, how vulnerable she is, here in a country that is not her own, where she does not even speak the language. They think with worry of their own daughters, and in the end, they relent. After all, the girl has her passport, Alice Shipley, the same surname as the imposing older woman who had first opened the account. The connection can be no coincidence. The woman set up the payments to care for her niece while in the hospital, and though they did not ask for what ailment, they can see now that she is cured. And the trust is in her name, so there is no reason to deny her. On the street, she smiles, feeling comfort, feeling the future alive and throbbing in the heft of her suitcase. She is not a thief, she reasons, for she has not taken everything, only what she is owed. For all the promises Alice made and broke, for the life she had whispered into being one cool autumn night, and that she had set alight in the bitter cold of winter. Afterward, she makes her way on to Alameda Principal and to Antigua Casa de Guardia, where she has developed a taste for Lágrima Transaniejo. She will have one last taste, in celebration, she has decided. And so she strolls slowly down the road, watching as families, couples walk along the middle of the street that runs through the city, a pulsing vein of activity. They stop at a flower stall just there, and then another one a few feet down, inspecting, haggling, before any purchases are made. Inside the bar, her mind relaxes. She watches as the chalk marks that the bartender leaves in front of her grow from 1 to 2 to 3. In the past, on bad days, she has ordered a small cask to take home with her. On the worst days, she paid for a hotel room in the city. Today, she feels the weight of her luggage and knows there will be no more such days. She signals to the bartender. Her bus leaves in little over half an hour, and she cannot miss it. The city name printed on her bus ticket, a hope, a dream she can no longer postpone. She hands over the coins, which the bartender counts quickly, before reaching into his pockets and handing her the correct amount of change. She shakes her head, indicating that the man should keep it as a tip, knowing that she can afford such things now. He tips his head in thanks. Lucy watches as the bartender takes out a cloth from his pockets, wiping it across the wooden countertop, the number of her drinks disappearing, until at last the counter is clean, and it is as though she were never there at all. This is Erin Mallon. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tangerine, a novel by Christine Mangan. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer Katie Estroka. Text copyright 2018 by Christine Mangan. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.